And as a matter of fact, it becomes infected so frequently that there is a separate diagnosis under Medicare just for infections of the dialysis catheter and sepsis secondary to the dialysis catheter, as opposed to just sepsis secondary from something else.
Hey out there, welcome back to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. My name is Rob. I will be your host for this episode. Today we are talking about the clinical conditions that are going to impair an individual nursing home resident's ability to heal a existing pressure injury. But we're certainly not having that conversation alone. We have the fantastic Dennis Collins on the show to walk us through this process. But up right now is the nursing home regulation question of the week and another opportunity for you to win the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast coffee mug. It is the perfect receptacle for your Earl Grey hot, as Jean-Luc Picard would consume. How do you win this, you might ask? Well, you're going to go to our TikTok, which is at Justice for Residents, at Justice for Residents. You're going to scroll, you're going to look for the thumbnail for this question of the week, which will be a big chunk of blue cheese. So look for the blue cheese. You're going to click on it. Then you're going to answer the regulation question of the week and input. I keep saying input like I'm AI generated. Comment your answer and then comment your favorite kind of cheese. My favorite kind of cheese has always been blue cheese. I've mentioned if this show has a drinking game, you drink whenever I talk about having the palate of an 85-year-old man. I've loved blue cheese and Roquefort, like pure, real blue cheese, since I was probably 6 or 7 years old. I will mention again that for a while in the 80s, at Wendy's, if you were to go to the fast food restaurant Wendy's, they had a salad bar. It was called the Super Bar. It was amazing. I would not get a hamburger or french fries. I would not get a Frosty. I would go with my father and I would get a salad and baked potato and drench everything in blue cheese. But they also sometimes, if I'm not mistaken, would have actual real blue cheese crumbles. So I might have just made that up. But I love blue cheese at the end of the day. So you don't have to like blue cheese. Whatever cheese you want. It can be, you know, Monterey Jack, mozzarella. What are the kids into? I don't know. Put that in there and you will be randomly selected to win the coffee mug. The winners are announced every single Sunday on our TikTok and at shinkfirm.com/podcast/giveaway. The prize ships at the end of the month. Good luck to you. All right. I think the difficulty level this week I'm going to say is medium hard. So if you get this right, go to your local grocery store, but the fancy one. So if you got a Whole Foods, go to Whole Foods. What do we have around here? I don't know. I guess I would go to the good Kroger. I'd go to the good Kroger. Go to the good cheese section, not this section that's kind of refrigerated with all the shredded cheeses where we always go. Go to the nice cheese place by the deli and get yourself some nice cheese if you get this correct. Under 42 CFR 483.15A3, which of the following is a facility not allowed to require as a condition of admission? Is it A, a person with legal access to the resident's income to sign the admission agreement? B, a third-party guarantee of payment as a condition of admission? Or C, a resident's method of payment for care services? And that answer is B. Under the federal regulations, the nursing home is not allowed to request a third party guarantee payment for that resident's care. All right, now it's time to get into the meat and potatoes of this episode. Today we have Dennis Collins on to talk with us about the clinical conditions that would impair someone's ability to heal from a wound. Dennis is a nationally certified legal nurse consultant and experienced nursing educator with over 20 years in emergency and critical care. He has taught at multiple institutions, including Duquesne University and Community College of Allegheny County.
Duquesne University.
See, I had to use Google to tell me how to say Duquesne. I've seen it written and it's spelled weird. Allegheny, I know. Like from previous experience, I know about Allegheny, how to say that. Duquesne, that was new to me. Dennis consults on both plaintiff and defense cases involving emergency nursing home and correctional care. A dedicated medical missionary, he has led 25 self-funded trips to Central America, providing care to underserved communities. And we're so happy to have him on the show today. Dennis, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Ready to talk to you today about some issues in wound care.
Very good.
I do have some background there. I have been a registered nurse for over 40 years, actually. Just got into being a part-time nurse educator now. I teach at our local community college in clinical as well as classroom, of course. And I started out as a teenage boy as an ambulance attendant. So this is all I've done all my life. I have been an emergency department manager, a case manager, an ER nurse, a flight nurse, did some corrections work. You pretty well name it. And I have been working as a, on a part-time basis as a legal nurse consultant for about the last 15, 16 years.
So we've laid the foundation that you are highly qualified to speak on today's topic. Appreciate that. The first thing is kind of like this is some people, based on their clinical condition, are going to heal faster from a pressure injury than others. So kind of the $64,000 question is, can you walk us through some of these clinical conditions that do have an effect on how long it's going to take that person to bounce back?
Absolutely. Certainly, there's nothing that affects wound healing of any sort, really, but certainly of the kind of injuries you're talking about, as diabetes. Diabetes has profound effects on the circulatory system. It works by decreasing the circulatory flow to parts of the body because of damages to the microcirculation. That's particularly true in the hands and feet, especially the feet. That's why you see a lot of diabetic wounds that won't get better in the lower extremities, certainly. Also, really anything that impairs the circulation, and you'll see people, older people, especially who have a lot of edema intermittently, a lot of swelling intermittently of the lower extremities, and that stretching and contracting of the skin also leads to skin breakdown and makes wound healing very difficult.
Can you quickly explain why impairment of circulation would have anything to do with the breakdown of skin?
Certainly. Less circulation to the extremity means less oxygen to the extremity. Blood carries oxygen and a variety of other nutrients to the tissue on the skin. And if it's getting a lower supply, it just tends to break down. This is particularly true if you have a point of pressure, a point of that person's body part contacting with something, the bed, footstool, whatever like that, a wheelchair perhaps is common and kind of wheelchair related injuries are common like that. And when a person isn't able to move much, then of course you're going to have pressure on that body part that's against there and you're going to get skin breakdown. And then because your blood sugar is not well controlled or poorly controlled, then you're going to get delayed healing in that extremity.
I see.
Really, okay. Any condition that affects the circulation. And logically, when your circulation is kind of breaking down, it's going to occur the furthest from your heart first, which is generally the lower extremities, the feet.
Which is typically why you might see pressure injuries to the heels, for example, in a diabetic.
Absolutely. That and 10 people tend to lay on, when they're in bed, if they're on their back, mostly it's their heels that are against or bearing most of their weight. So, yeah. And if they can't be repositioned and turned frequently and that area isn't watched or specific measures taken about that, that is going to break down first. And it just does vary with the individual, but really anything that affects circulation is going to affect that. And that's why you'll also see diabetic people who maybe what they've done is they've stuck their toe in the water in the bathtub or whatever, and they're not really aware that it's burning because they have a decreased sensation there. And so they end up getting burned, and that's the start of the skin breakdown. Or for that matter, they could have just cut it somehow, and they're not really aware of that even.
Right, because I guess it's this, the in somebody that is cognitively intact, a deficit in sensory perception is a risk, because if you can't feel your sacrum or your heel burning, that's going to be a problem. You're going to be more likely to develop an injury because you're not there to be like, oh man, that kind of hurts.
Well, it's simple. If you touch a hot toaster and you have an intact feeling, you're going to pull your finger away. But if you don't, you might leave it there for a while. Sure. That's more or less the same thing.
Yeah. Okay. So we have circulation issues. Kind of what's our next heavy bullet point for what would hinder a wound from healing?
I would say that incontinence certainly is a big factor. And many older people in extended care facilities, or even as home patients, tend to have a lot of urinary or fecal incontinence, And that moisture being against the skin particularly tends to break the skin down. If that skin isn't well cared for, the person isn't repositioned and so on. Particularly, that's why you see them breaking down or getting some really bad ulcers on the coccyx area, you know, the bottom, small of the back, the top of the buttocks right there. That's why you see that there. You can actually see it in a pattern where the person's moisture would be, you know, most intact, most prevalent.
And so I guess from just kind of like a, I don't know, like a real basic standpoint, moisture tends to weaken the skin. And then when you're dealing with fecal matter or urine, there are substances inside those, aside from just being moist, that are further weakening the skin.
Absolutely. Urine sometimes is quite acidic. It can break down the skin, certainly. How bad fecal matter breaks down the skin depends on the diet, if any, and just not trying to be gross, but just laying in that is going to cause the skin to break down.
Because I think that at least for me, there's like a misconception with the family members that have a loved one in a nursing home. When they, you know, you're explaining this to them, it's like, you know, it's not just about moisture, like when you're out of the bathtub or you're out of the shower. It's sweat. It's that incontinence. It's the, you know, sweat, particularly like against mechanical equipment, these type of things that people don't think about. That's the danger.
Then also in that setting, you have to realize that if they're changing the bed or changing, you know, the pads under the person or whatever, and they're pulling laterally, you know, to move the bedding under that person, that's shear on the skin, that sideways pressure, lateral pressure, can sometimes cause a skin injury, which in turn can break down.
I see. Okay. So just as a quick aside, if you have an incontinent resident, and let's say that the intervention for them, at least for the short term, is an adult brief.
Okay.
What are some of the things that you're doing to prevent that, at least tamper or lessen how moisture affects the skin?
You're changing and documenting. This is where I find a lot of it as a consultant. It's not real documented that this has been done on a regular basis. Like what the effect was, how the skin looked at that time. You're not, you know, it's being done occasionally, but not on any kind of a regular basis. And that's something that you have to look at.
I see.
It's better to do it every few hours, for instance, not better than it is do it every 6 or 8. And, you know, people also, like I said, when they're being turned, are they being turned off that pressure area? There are mattresses and things that kind of rotate the patient a little bit for you, you know, by pumping up the air and changing the pressure underneath the person and that sort of thing. But how often is that set to? How often is that being done? How often is the person being evaluated for being incontinent? And how's the skin looking at that time? There are also various, there are things like barrier creams and other things like that too that can help. But ultimately, they have to be turned and repositioned fairly frequently.
So here's something. So you mentioned barrier cream as a potential intervention for moisture, right? But I guess how do we kind of square that with the fact that if moisture's bad, why would kind of like, I guess, a almost quasi moist mixture of, you know, be okay? Why would a cream be okay?
Because you have dried the skin thoroughly first, okay, of any kind of urine or anything like that. Then you have put a given a certain amount of cream on there that is going to form a barrier to those more abrasive things or more irritating things. So if yes, it is moist, and yes, it is chemically and so on and so forth, but it's providing a barrier against more harmful things.
I see. So,
but that is not a cure-all end-all, but that is a very good one way to approach it.
So we've described conditions affecting the circulation, or at least the ability, the body's ability to circulate the blood and get the nutrients from the blood. We've talked about moisture. What's kind of next on our hit list?
I'm going to say, just not turning and repositioning, not being able to move, possibly being against a railing or against the edge of something else on the bed or near the bed. Those are all factors. Like if my hand is against something for a long time, that's going to break the skin down. So look for things that are done with the person or not done with the person that can contribute to skin breakdown. Sometimes just being gotten out of bed for therapy or put up in a chair, you know, can be injurious, something like that.
So I imagine that then things like hemiplegia, paralysis, muscle weakness, these are things that, you know, increase the likelihood of pressure injury simply because the person is unable to change their own weight.
Certainly. And if you have, say, hemiplegia as a result of a stroke, a CVA or something, you're going to have, that's got to be a particular area of attention because the person can't do anything with that at all. They can't move that away from what's irritating. They can't get off it because something is hurting it really bad. They can't do it. So you have to pay particular attention to that.
And it really is a truth. Like my brother-in-law, who at the time was, you know, a physically incredibly fit 30-year-old male, mm-hmm. was in a motorcycle accident, and he couldn't move half his body. And but the day before he could bench press 400 pounds, but then he's not able, just from the sheer weight of half of his body being, you know, out of commission, mm-hmm. he couldn't do these things for himself. Like even with the strength that he had for the rest of his body. So like, you don't, in your mind, it's like, oh, if I can't move my leg or I can't move my arm, like I'm still able to make micro shifts or whatever. That might not be the case at all.
Sometimes you can and sometimes you can't. It just depends on the degree of disability, how badly, you know, your CVA has affected you. Sometimes it gets a little better and then you can reposition it somewhat. It just depends. And the same would go for someone with a spinal injury or anything of that nature. I mean, it virtually ends up to be the same thing. You have lost control of some functions of your body.
I see. Okay, so now we have somebody that is kind of physically can't move themselves. What's the next? I guess this will be the final one. We promised the audience five, and this will be the fifth one.
Well, you're asking me what would another factor be? I'm sorry.
Another clinical condition that would inhibit a wound from healing.
Basically, anything that is immunocompromising. I'll just use an example. If a patient has cancer and they're a chemotherapy patient, chemotherapy tends to predispose you to infections, delay wound healing, things of that nature because of its anti-inflammatory nature. Okay. So you are on a setup for that, certainly. Anybody who's getting in, this is where nutrition plays a big role also. Anybody who is getting, inadequate nutrition is leading to tissue breakdown, particularly with pressure on those areas. If your skin turgor, in other words, if you would grab the skin on the back of your hand and kind of tent it up and let go of it, it would spring back right away. Theirs will not, because they've lost a lot of that turgor, a lot of that tone. It's almost consistent with people I've seen in Central America, even who are very dehydrated or malnourished. You will see that same thing. And that skin is going to break down because it's not getting all the fluids and nutrients and things like that that it needs to get.
So I guess in terms of malnutrition, mm-hmm. what are we looking for? Like what nutrition would you give somebody who is either has a wound or is at risk for developing them?
Well, what you're looking for with the wound is, are they getting adequate vitamins A, C, and E especially? Okay. And also protein. Protein is very critical to wound healing. This is why, for instance, if someone has isn't able to take orally, or the dietitian should look at them and determine, based on their skin wound or whatever, what the optimal nutrition is. Okay. The dietitian should be able to tell you, okay, we need this much of this vitamin mixture, this much water, this much protein. And there are various ways of delivering that. The most common, if the person can't take orally or someone can't feed them, is to have a tube feeding. Okay. Unfortunately, what you get into with tube feeding, well, it's not really meant for long term. But what you get into it with is, if it's going in a nasal tube, it's going to give you some skin irritation and breakdown here. And if usually it's through the abdominal wall, if it's going to be any longer term, it's going to give you some skin breakdown there too. But if it's delivered at the right rate via a pump and the right mixture, it can pretty well optimize the person's nutrition, especially in the short term. But you have to look at his dietary, seeing them. A dietary doesn't make orders, incidentally, they make recommendations, and the physician has to order, okay, use that tube feeding. There are so many different kinds of tube feeding mixtures. I couldn't begin to say, but I can think of over a dozen right off the top of my head, and some of them are optimized for, say, a burn, or some of them are optimized for just a tissue injury. Other ones are for people who have pulmonary issues, so it doesn't cause mucus in the respiratory tract and things like that. Blood sugar, of course, there are many for blood sugar, many for people with bad kidneys. You can optimize what is given to the person with a good dietary consultant if they're following the patient.
I knew about protein as a macro for pressure injuries. I hadn't heard you said vitamin A and E,
A, C, and E.
A, C, and E. And also, I've heard zinc, but I had not heard A, C, and E. I've heard zinc and protein. That was about it.
Yes. Well, zinc is actually sometimes added to a wound healing paste that is applied to the wound area for that same reason. But A, C, and E, I mean, think back historically when people would get scurvy, when they're old-time ships and things, that was because there was no vitamin C in their diet, and that would tend to break their skin down, make them ill. So yeah, you do have to optimize your nutrition.
Which is also my understanding as to why we refer to the British as limeys.
I did not know that.
That could be false, but I think it's one of those things that I've heard, but I've never verified it. But that's my understanding, is that's where the term limey comes from, is they always had limes with them for
Or
scurvy.
they would look to obtain something with vitamin C. I know the old treatment for scurvy. I mean, it was more folklore than anything. It was, as soon as you got to an island, bury the person up to their necks for like 24 hours in the ground. And of course, that's not sound or anything like that, but I think it must have got some results at one time, because just what might have been in the soil.
Right, exactly. So tell me about let's do a bonus clinical condition. So what about dialysis? How does dialysis and renal disease factor into this?
Okay, well, renal disease basically means that you're losing your kidney function. Okay, and the degree of kidney function loss, without getting overly detailed, is measured with a lab test called a glomerular filtration rate, or GFR. Generally, if your GFR is below 50 for more than a short time, it's going to be associated with development stage 3 kidney disease, which then continues, if the function continues to decline, it's going to get worse, progressively worse. Okay. Dialysis takes these waste products out of the body, runs it through a very sophisticated filtering system, and then puts it back in. Okay. Again, people who have dialysis frequently have electrolytes like sodium, potassium, all out of whack, and also have a very high blood sugar, because sometimes, unfortunately, diabetes goes with this as well. Okay, so if the blood sugar is not being well managed, if the electrolyte balance is not being well managed, then wound healing cannot occur. Also, with dialysis, unfortunately, when the people aren't getting it, they tend to get edema in the extremities, or the lower back. If they're on their back all the time, fluid tends to pull back there, and that contributes to skin breakdown as well. Also, the dialysis catheter itself. Dialysis is usually achieved through what's called an AV shunt in this kind of a setting, where they make a connection to your circulation right here, and the blood goes out, the arterial blood goes out, and it's put back in the venous side. That's hence the name AV shunt. And that device, that catheter, which is surgically implanted, frequently becomes infected. And as a matter of fact, it becomes infected so frequently that there is a separate diagnosis under Medicare just for infections of the dialysis catheter and sepsis secondary to the dialysis catheter, as opposed to just sepsis secondary from something else. So it is a major problem. Also, when you have a dialysis catheter and you're doing dialysis, you have to maintain proper aseptic technique at all times. That can't get dirty. That can't get anything like that. So that's a concern too. But absolutely, poor kidney function, of course, means, you know, is reflective of poor body function, and that's going to break the skin down.
Very well said. Well, Dennis, I appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your knowledge with us today.
Sure. Well, it was nice to be here. Thank you.
Well, folks, I hope you found this episode educational. If you have an idea for a topic that you'd like for me to talk about, please let me know. If you have an idea for someone that you would like for me to talk to, please let me know that as well. What was the hint for today? Oh, it was the cheese. Be sure to participate in the TikTok giveaway and win yourself a Nursing Home Abuse Podcast mug. I think if it wasn't blue cheese, what is my next favorite cheese? I'm just going to say like aged Vermont white cheddar. Because technically, all cheese is white and cheddar is colored with like coloring. I don't know if that's common knowledge or not. I learned that like yesterday. But Vermont aged cheddar, that's a good one too. Anyway, whatever it is, comment, win the cup, get these cups out of my house. New episodes of the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast come out every single Monday. And with that, folks, we'll see you next time. Thanks for tuning in to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. Nothing said on this podcast, either by the host or the guest, should be construed as legal or medical advice, nor is intended to create an attorney-client relationship between the host or their guest and the listener. New episodes, for now, are available every other Monday on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or on your favorite podcast app, as well as on YouTube and our website, nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. Again, that's nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. See you next time.